This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I am going to talk today about the neurobiology of hatred, why love turns to hatred, and what we can do about it. Sacred text and ancient drama tell a truth we'd rather not acknowledge, that love and hatred are intimately bound. We hear of Cain killing his brother Abel, Medea's murder of her children, and Julius Caesar's being sentenced to death by his closest friends. In fact, the closer the band, the greater the potential for hatred. Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung spoke about the interchangeable nature of love and hatred. Freud writes in Civilization and Its Discontent, "Besides the drive to preserve living substance and to join it into ever larger units, there must exist another, contrary drive seeking to dissolve those units and to bring them back to their primeval, inorganic state." And Jung writes, "The God I experienced is more than love, he's also hate. He's more than beauty, he's also an abomination. He's more than wisdom, he's also meaninglessness." Today, I'll present our model on the neurobiology of hatred, and this would let us think why enemies is a love story and why love is often a story of hate. Hatred is based on the same three foundations of the biology of love. These foundations are ancient and evolved to enable social connection and protection of our loved ones. The ancient systems that support love are behavior-based and can be hijacked by aggression, derogation, and destruction out of the fear to the safety of those we love. Because these systems are survival-focused and automatic, even minor variation in social behavior spells danger and trigger all of the body's alarm system. After all, when you live in a jungle, you don't contemplate whether the noise outside your door is a panther or a fallen branch, you attack. Let us look at the three foundations of the biology of love. The first foundation is biobehavioral synchrony, which is defined as the coordination of biology and behavior during social contact. The second foundation is oxytocin. It's an ancient system implicated in sociality, stress management, and well-being that sustains attachment. And the third foundation is the attachment network in the brain. It's based on the maternal caregiving network in mammals, and it evolved in humans to include networks of empathy, mentalization, and foresight. The first foundation of the biology of love is biobehavioral synchrony. When mothers and infants synchronize their first social signals, their gaze, cooing, affective expression, gesture, and movement, these synchronized moments provide a template for the coordination of their biological processes. In a series of studies, we found that during these coordinated moments, there's also synchrony between mother and infant heart rhythms. There is a coordinated release of oxytocin in parent and child, and there is brain-to-brain synchrony in keynotes of the social brain. As children grow, synchrony expands from nonverbal coordination to include symbolic and empathic components, and the interaction becomes more mutual. Once encoded in the brain within the mother-infant bond, biobehavioral synchrony transfers to other intimate relationships children will form throughout life with friends, lovers, mentors, colleagues, and eventually with their own children. All these bonds of love are built on the synchrony of biology and behavior. However, synchrony is an ancient process that is easily turned into outgroup derogation. Synchrony has its roots in the coordination of small organisms into groups through biobehavior motor coupling. The higher order mechanisms that evolved in human on top of the motor coupling of fisher birds allow us to derogate and determine who belongs to us and can join the group, and who is defined as them and can be hated and destroyed. Such derogation intensifies at times of danger. We all remember the slogan, "Together we stand," after 9/11, which basically means that our synchronized group sends an ominous message to those who pose real or imaginary threat to our loved ones. The second foundation of the biology of love is oxytocin and its sister molecule, vasopressin. Oxytocin and vasopressin evolved approximately 500 million years ago from the same ancient parent molecule, vasotocin. Their role across animal evolution was to help organisms manage life in harsh ecologies. With the evolution of mammals, the two were integrated into bonding and their roles split. Oxytocin became involved in controlling birth and lactation and in the calmness needed for love. Vasopressin was integrated into male bonding that requires aggression, vigilance, and territorial defense in protecting mother and young. However, oxytocin and vasopressin are structurally similar and are easily interchangeable in the service of bonding. Oxytocin is involved in the safety, quiescence, and calm states that give rise to love. Vasopressin is implicated in the defense, vigilance, and aggression that give rise to hatred. But the two peptides are closely linked. They can ride on each other's receptors and are easily interchangeable in the brain, particularly during times of danger and ongoing conflict. The third foundation of the biology of love is the attachment network in the brain. The human attachment network evolved on top of the mammalian caregiving network. This subcortical automatic network assembles in the mother's brain after the birth of her infant and allows mammalian mothers to care for their infants. In humans, cortical networks of resonance, reflection, and foresight evolved on top of the ancient maternal caregiving network, and the two parts integrated into a global human attachment network. These cortical networks are a blessing and a curse. They enhance parents' ability to care for their children, but they also enable us to worry about the future, attribute evil intentions to others, and plan aggression in the name of love. When children enter the social world at 3 to 5 years of age and begin to form friendships and social groups, the three foundations of the biology of love enable the transfer from the intimacy of the parent-infant bond to life within social groups. During that transition from the intimacy of bond to life within social group, the three foundations partition to the biology of love and the biology of hatred. Due to their precarious and interchangeable nature, the three foundations can support safety, cooperation, empathy, and love, but also vigilance, fear, defense, and hatred. With this in mind, we built the Tool of Dialogue Intervention. It is a group intervention for Israeli and Palestinian youth who are a fourth generation born into a bleeding conflict. The intervention is conducted in groups of 12 participants, half Jewish and half Arab. They are unisex and are moderated by two leaders in each language. It's the first intervention to combat hatred based on the neurobiology of love. Before and after the intervention is 8 sessions, each of 2.5 hours. There's a full day of assessment of the brain using magnetoencephalography, MED. There's one-on-one interaction with members of the in-group and the out-group. There is an in-depth interview about attitudes toward the conflicts, and there are 5 saliva samples that we later assay for oxytocin and cortisol. That happens also after the intervention, and the control have it again 2 months later. And 7 years later, when youth were 25 years old, we conducted an in-depth interview on their peace-building attitude and involvement in peace-building efforts in their community. So there are 8 sessions. Each session begins and ends with synchronous acts like shared movements, songs in Hebrew or Arabic, or joint chanting to prepare body and brain to synchrony. Each session is devoted to a special topic. So session 1 and 2 is to familiarity and affiliation. 3 and 4, we discuss about conflict and conflict resolution and prejudice, then about modes of dialogue and empathy. And the final 2 is to conclusion and commitment. And our goal was to give the enemy a face and individuality and learn behavior strategies of dialogue. The tools of dialogue intervention, it's conducted within the framework of an RCT, a randomized control trial. You see some examples of group activity and individual dyadic activity. And here to the finding. First, behavior. The intervention increased behavioral synchrony and empathy during the one-on-one dialogue with member of the outgroup. You see here in the green, it increased behavioral coordination, empathy, mutual respect, and acknowledgement of the other's emotion following the dialogue intervention. As for hormones, intervention suppressed the cortisol production during encounter with outgroup member that enables approach, and we also saw an oxytocin increase. And then we looked at the brain, both at brain mechanism and at translation. The brain basis of hatred involves 2 mechanisms: aborting the brain's neural empathic response to the enemy's pain, at sustaining prejudice of his evilness. Without these brain mechanisms of hatred, humans would not be able to inflict pain on their enemies or sustain hatred for generations. Both mechanisms can be rescued by the tools of dialogue intervention. Let's look at the first mechanism, at the brain basis of empathy. And here we use DeSetti's well-validated stimuli showing hands and feet in pain versus no pain. And much research showed that the brain activates a resonating empathic response to other pain in the sensory motor cortex, in S1. We added a component. Before presentation of the pain stimuli, we tag the protagonist as member of the in-group or member of the out-group. So appeared on the screen, this is Ahmed from Kfar Kara, or this is Dan from Tel Aviv. This is Samira from Jaljulia, or this is Sarah from Netanya. So the participant knew whether the pain is inflicted on member of his in-group or out-group. The response to others' pain in S1, sensory motor area in the brain, here it is, has 2 components, an automatic and a cognitive. The first 500 milliseconds is the brain's automatic response, and it involves suppression of alpha rhythms. It marks the brain emotional resonance to the pain of others. The next 1500 milliseconds index the brain's higher order cognitive response. It places the pain in context and it devises a plan of helpful action. This component is human specific and involves alpha enhancement. Let's see what happens. The first automatic response, the first 500 milliseconds, a bottom-up response, occurred towards both in-group, the straight line, and the dotted line, the out-group. However, the next top-down response was shut down toward the out-group. For the pain of out-group, the response was not even different from the baseline. It tells us that the brain does not register the pain of those we hate. without shutting down the brain's empathic response, humans would not be able to inflict pain on their enemies. The second mechanism we tested was the brain basis of prejudice, and we used the implicit association test, the IAT, which is a highly validated paradigm to assess implicit intergroup prejudice. The IAT is built on research showing that it takes the brain a bit longer to process incongruent information like black and good if you are a white supremacist than congruent information. The difference in milliseconds between the response to congruent and incongruent information defines the implicit intergroup bias. Here we exposed the participants in the magnet. They sit in the magnet and they see screens for about 20 minutes in Hebrew and in Arabic that define a Jew and an Arab with a set of adjectives. A Jew is clean, is good, is generous. An Arab is clean, is good, is generous. And what we saw is that throughout the prejudice paradigm, there was a consistent alpha activation in the brain. This tells us that the brain registers prejudice as something that requires special attention. And it registers it in the right lingual gyrus. It's part of the visual system that is responsible for visual processing and visual memory. And that response in the right lingual was synchronized, was connected with a higher order response in the MCC, the medial cingulate cortex, which is involved in social processing and social decision making. The neural marker of prejudice involves alpha rhythm activity in right lingual across the entire paradigm to sustain the intergroup bias. And it's synchronized with activity in the medial cingulate cortex. Now, what happens after the intervention? What happens to the neural markers of prejudice after the tools of dialogue intervention that increases familiarity, dialogue, and synchrony? So first we looked at the behavioral response at reaction time, and we see that for control, it did not change at all. But for those who underwent the intervention, it was no longer seen. It was completely abolished. And when it came to the brain, we saw reduction in the neural prejudice response only among the intervention participants. So here is a sustained alpha response in the right lingual throughout the paradigm before. And here is the same sustained alpha response in the right lingual throughout the paradigm after the intervention, 2 months later. But for the intervention, you see the sustained response before and no prejudice response later. The brain does not register prejudice as something it should be paying attention to. But more than that, the degree of reduction in the participants' neural marker of prejudice predicted their attitudes and involvement in peacemaking activities 7 years later as adults. We see that an intervention based on the biology of love is the only one that can release the impact of hatred on the brain, even hatred lasting for generations. To conclude, systems sustaining love are ancient and behavior-based. The systems that evolve to support love can turn into hatred in a heartbeat, out of fear to the safeties of our loved one and our abstract attachments like homeland or religion. Interventions to combat hatred should be behavior-based, target the neurobiology of love, and provide opportunities for active synchrony and resonance. The tools of dialogue intervention can induce lasting effects on brain behavior and attitude, telling us that we must never give up on the possibility of peace. I'd like to end by thanking our Tools of Dialogue team, my lab members, the Fetzer Foundation, who supported the Israeli-Palestinian projects, And thank you for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.